Part 1. Had I not known that I was dead already, I would have mourned my loss of life. Last words of Otodokan, scholar of military arts and poet, 1486. Chapter 1. Once you get past the overall irony of the situation, you realize that killing a guy in the middle of his own health club has a lot to recommend it. The target was a Yakuza, an iron freak named Ishihara who worked out every day in a gym he owned in Roppongi, one of Tokyo's entertainment districts. Tots had told me the hit had to look like natural causes, like they always do, so I was glad to be working in a venue where it was far from unthinkable that someone might keel over from a fatal aneurysm induced by exertion, or suffer an unlucky fall onto a steel bar, or undergo some other tragic mishap while using one of the complicated exercise machines. One of these eventualities might even be immortalized in the warnings corporate lawyers would insist on placing on the next generation of exercise equipment to notify the public of yet another unnatural use for which the machine was not intended and of which the manufacturer would have to remain blameless. Over the years, my work has made me the anonymous recipient of at least two such legal encomia. One, on a bridge traversing the polluted waters of the Sumida River, in which a certain politician drowned in 1982. Warning, do not climb on these bars. Another, a decade later, following the aquatic electrocution of an unusually diligent banker on the packaging of hair dryers. Warning, do not use while bathing. The health club was also convenient because I wouldn't have to worry about fingerprints. In Japan, where costumes are a national pastime, a weightlifter wouldn't pump iron without wearing stylish padded gloves any more than a politician would take a bribe in his underwear. It was a warm early spring for Tokyo, portending, they said, a fine cherry blossom season. And where else but at a gym could a man in gloves have gone unnoticed? In my business, going unnoticed is half the game. People put out signals: body language, gait, clothes, facial expression, posture, attitude, speech, mannerisms, that can tell you where they're from, what they do, who they are. Most importantly, do they fit in? Because if you don't fit in, the target will spot you, and after that you won't be able to get close enough to do it right. Or a cop will spot you, and you'll have some explaining to do. Or a counter-surveillance team will spot you, and then, congratulations, the target will be you. But if you're attentive, you begin to understand that the identifying signals are a science, not an art. You watch, you imitate, you acquire. Eventually, you can shadow different targets through different societal ecosystems, remaining anonymous in all of them. Anonymity wasn't easy for me in Japan when my parentage was a matter of public record and schoolyard taunts. But today, you wouldn't spot the Caucasian in my face unless someone tipped you off that it was there to be found. My American mother wouldn't have minded that. She had always wanted me to fit in Japan, and was glad that my father's Japanese features had prevailed in that initial genetic struggle for dominance. And the plastic surgery I had undergone when I returned to Japan after my fling with U.S. Special Forces in Vietnam largely completed the job that chance and nature had begun. The story my signals would tell the Yakuza was simple. He'd only begun seeing me at his gym recently, but I was already obviously in shape. So I wasn't some middle-aged guy who'd decided to take up weightlifting to try and regain a lost college-era physique. The more likely explanation would be that I worked for a company that had transferred me to Tokyo, and, if they had sprung for digs near Roppongi, maybe in Minami Aoyama or Azabu, I must be someone reasonably important and well-compensated. That I was apparently into bodybuilding at all at this stage in my life probably meant affairs with young women for whom a youthful physique might ameliorate the unavoidable emotional consequences of sleeping with an older man in what at root would be little more than an exchange of sex and the illusion of immortality for Ferragamo handbags and the other implicit currencies of such arrangements, all of which the Yakuza would understand and even respect. In fact, my recent appearance at the Yakuza's gym had nothing to do with a company transfer. It was more like a business trip. After all, I was in Tokyo just to do a job. When the job was finished, I would leave. I'd done some things to generate animosity when I'd been living here, and the relevant parties might still be looking for me, even after I'd been away for a year, so a short stay was all I could sensibly afford. Tots had given me a dossier on the Yakuza a month earlier, when he'd found me and persuaded me to take the job. From the contents, I would have concluded the target was just mob muscle, but I knew he must be more than that if Tots wanted him eliminated. I hadn't asked. I only wanted the particulars that would help me get close. The rest was irrelevant. The dossier had included the Yakuza's mobile number. I had fed it to Harry, who, compulsive hacker that he was, had long since penetrated the cellular network control centers of Japan's three telco providers. Harry's computers were monitoring the movements of the Yakuza's mobile phone within the network. Anytime the phone got picked up by the tower covering the area around the Yakuza's health club, Harry paged me. Tonight, the page had come at just after 8 o'clock, while I was reading in my room at the New Otani Hotel in Akasaka Mitsuke. The club closed at 8, I knew, so if the Yakuza was working out there after hours, there was a good possibility he'd be alone, what I'd been waiting for. My workout gear was already in a bag, and I was out the door within minutes. I caught a cab a slight distance from the hotel, not wanting a doorman to hear or remember where I might be going, and 5 minutes later, I exited at the corner of Roppongi Dori and Gaien Higashi Dori in Roppongi. I hated to use such a direct route because doing so limited my opportunities to ensure I wasn't being followed, but I had only a little time to pull this off the way I'd planned and decided it was worth the risk. I had been watching the Yakuza for over a month now and knew his routines. I'd learned that he liked to vary the times of his workouts, sometimes arriving at the gym early in the morning, sometimes at night. Probably he assumed the resulting unpredictability would make him hard to get to. He was half right. Unpredictability is the key to being a hard target, but the concept applies to both time and place. Half measures like this guy's will protect you from some of the people some of the time, but they won't save you for long from someone like me. Strange how people can take adequate, even strong security measures in some respects, while leaving themselves vulnerable in others, like double locking the front door and leaving the windows wide open. Sometimes the phenomenon is caused by fear. Fear not so much of the requirements, but rather of the consequences of life as a hard target. Seriously protecting yourself calls for the annihilation of ties with society, ties that most people need the way they need oxygen. You give up friends, family, romance. You walk through the world like a ghost, detached from the living around you. If you were to die in, say, a bus accident, you'd wind up buried in an obscure municipal graveyard, just another John Doe. No flowers, no mourners, hell, no mourning. It's natural, probably even desirable, to be afraid of all this. Other times there's a form of denial at work. Circuitous routes, extensive security checks, an ongoing internal dialogue consisting of, if I were trying to get to me, how would I do it? All require a deep acceptance of the notion that there are people out there who have both the motive and the means to cut short your time on Earth. This notion is innately uncomfortable for the human psyche, so much so that it produces enormous stress even for soldiers in battle. A lot of guys, the first time they come under close-range fire, they're shocked. Why is he trying to kill me? They're asking themselves. What did I ever do to him? Think about it. Ever look in a closet or under the bed when you're alone in the house to ensure an intruder isn't hiding there? Now, if you really believed the man in the black ski mask was lurking in those places, would you behave the same way? Of course not. But it's more comfortable to believe the danger only in the abstract and to act on it only half-heartedly. That's denial. Finally, and most obviously, there is laziness. Who has the time or energy to inspect the family car for improvised explosive devices before every drive? Who can afford a 2-hour roundabout route to get to a place that could have been reached directly in 10 minutes? Who wants to pass up a restaurant or bar because the only seats available face the wall, not the entrance? Rhetorical questions, but I know how Crazy Jake would have answered. The living, he would have said, and the ones who intend to go on that way. Which leads to an easy rationalization, one I'm sure is common to people who have taken lives the way I have. If he'd really wanted to live, the rationalization goes, I wouldn't have been able to get to him. He wouldn't have permitted himself that weakness, the one that did him in. The Yakuza's weakness was his addiction to weights. Who knows what fueled it? A history of childhood bullying that made him want to appear visibly strong afterward, an attempt to overcome a feeling of inadequacy born of being naturally slighter of build than Caucasians, some suppressed homoeroticism like the one that drove Mishima, maybe some of the same impulses that had led him to become a gangster to begin with. His obsession had nothing to do with health, of course. In fact, the guy was an obvious steroid abuser. His neck was so thick it looked as though he could slide a tie-up over his head without loosening the knot, and he sported acne so severe that the club's stark incandescent lighting, designed to show off to maximum effect the rips and cuts club members had developed in their bodies, cast small shadows over the pocked landscape of his face. His testicles were probably the size of raisins, his blood pressure likely rampaging through an overworked heart. I'd also seen him explode into the kind of abrupt, unprovoked violence that is another symptom of steroid abuse.